It went straight down the middle. Then it started to...
Well, welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game, and Bruce Devlin, we've got a return guest today who's going to be able to tell us what the weather's like tomorrow, so I'm anxious to hear about what kind of weather we can expect tomorrow. But I also know he was a big fan of Roy Little.
Well, he should be, too. He was victor there in 1963 and a great partner for me many times. We played a lot of golf together, won the CBS Golf Classic together. And it is indeed a pleasure to have my dear friend Bob Charles back again. Sir Bob Charles, I might add as well. Robert, thanks for joining us again today. We look forward to talking about your golf career, which is quite fantastic.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's good to see you, Bruce, and have a little chat with you about old times. And they certainly go back quite a while, don't they? If you turned 80, you're 86 coming up, aren't you?
No, I'm 85 coming up.
Yeah, October. Did I see your birthday's in October, is it?
Yeah, October I'll be 85.
Oh, you're 85. Okay, yeah.
I bow to my senior. I bow to my senior.
Well, Bob, you may recall the first time we got together, we talked a lot about the early years, you growing up in New Zealand and how you came to learn the game. We talked a little bit about your early amateur career. And I think where we left it, we had been talking about the 1958 Eisenhower Trophy and your great experiences with your first exposure at the amateur that year to the old course. And of course, that was the inaugural Eisenhower Trophy. Bobby Jones was a participant as the honorary captain on the U.S. side. The Aussies, the New Zealanders did quite well in that event. As a matter of fact, Bruce, I think I recall the Aussies kind of sneaking in there in the last round, and Bruce Devlin not doing too bad himself.
Well, we were very fortunate because the New Zealanders were leading after the three rounds, and then we played steadily the last day, but it took a bit of a catastrophe that Bob will tell us about in a minute, just towards the end of the round where the New Zealanders let us sneak by them. Robert?
Yeah, well, we were naturally disappointed in the final day. I don't know how many we're leading by, one, two, three, but John Durry, one of our team members from New Zealand, he made a 10 on the road hole. Road hole 17, isn't it? The one with the big bunker.
14.
The 14th, the par 5. He made a 10 there, and I think a 5 would have won for us. And my putting let me down that particular day. I had something like 40 strokes to the greens and 40. Well, I hit the 40 putts altogether, which included a drive and three putts on the 18th. My second shot was off the road on the 18th, and so I had a drive and three putts for a par on the last hole. But the damage was already done, and take my hat off to the USA and, of course, Australia, who tied and had a playoff the next day and to be won by... Did you win the individual, Bruce? I can't...
I did, yes, Bob, I sure did.
Well, belated congratulations.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, Bob.
Now, Bruce, you probably recall, but Bob Charles has come up with a number of our guests, and most of it revolves around what a great putter he is. I remember very specifically Gary Player bringing him up and talking about what a fantastic putter this guy was. I can't imagine him taking 40 putts anytime.
No, well, you got to understand, too, the R&A greens are rather large, and if your iron plays a little off, you can have a lot of long putts, can't you, Bob?
That's quite right, yeah.
But that is unusual for Mr. Charles. He's usually a pretty good putter, and I'm sure he can remember when he and I won the CBS Golf Classic. He just carried me around there for about five or six holes with birdie, 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 birdie. So it was fun watching it.
Well, we're going to come back to that, but before we do that, I want to stay in the 50s, and before we get to your second Eisenhower Trophy experience at Marion Golf Club, you guys both participated at Johannesburg in 1959 in the Commonwealth Tournament, didn't you?
Yes, well, I was part of the New Zealand team, and the Commonwealth included the Canadians, the Great Britain and Ireland, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. It was the inaugural event, and I don't know how we did. I'm not even sure whether South Africa won. Bruce would probably know better than what I do, but of course, the memorable thing about the going to Johannesburg in 1959 was meeting my wife to be, and we corresponded for a couple of years, and finally married in 1962, which is what, 60 years ago.
That's right.
So we're about to celebrate our 60th wedding anniversary. When I say wedding, wedded bliss.
There you go. There you go. Verity will enjoy that comment, I can assure you, Robert.
So you're able to go back to the Eisenhower Trophy. This would have been the second iteration of this event at Marion. I know I've heard Bruce's memories of that, because that was when Mr. Jack Nicklaus asserted himself on a very tough golf course, played a tournament there that and a game that, as Bobby Jones says, I'm not familiar with, in setting the scoring record there at Marion. But I think New Zealand tied was fifth on the team competition. You finished sixth individually. The Aussies were second to the Americans. But Bruce, you probably recall a little bit about that one.
Yeah, that was. It wouldn't have mattered how good Bob Charles or Bruce Devlin would have played. Mr. Nicklaus broke Hogan's scoring record there. As you said, we finished second, and Jack was the individual leader, and then Dean Beeman was behind him, and I ended up in third place. But I needed a bus to get to Jack. He was so far in front of me.
As far as that tournament goes, it was well. I'd now what I'd had 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 overseas trips for international play, and so by then I was starting to prior to that, but by then I had really made up my mind to turn professional, and in fact I did. I think the that Eisenhower at Marion finished something like was it September. But within 2 months of returning to New Zealand from that Eisenhower at Marion, I turned pro.
So is that something you'd been thinking about for a long time, and it was just sort of fait accompli, or was it a more of a sudden decision you came to?
Well, no, the seed was in my mind from the moment that I won the New Zealand Open at the age of 18, back to 1954. And Dick Penfold, of course, Penfold, you probably not. It's a British company, A.E. Yeah. Penfold. He happened to be in New Zealand at the time, and he virtually made me an offer to turn pro at that time. So I waited 6 years, another 6 years before I did turn pro. And but in that interim period, I had a huge amount of experience, as I said, playing international golf.
Yeah, let's just recap for our listeners very briefly the professional career of Sir Bob Charles, turning pro, as he said, in end of 1960 at the age of 24. He had 80 professional wins, including 6 on the PGA Tour, 10 wins on the European Tour, and 24 wins on the New Zealand Tour, 25 senior PGA Tour wins as well, which ties Bob for fourth all-time on that list. And on the PGA Tour and in general, of course, one major, that being the 1963 Open Championship at Royal Lytham, which we'll talk about. But before we do, we thought we'd talk about some of your other more significant wins. I don't think we have time to talk about all 80, but there were a lot of significant wins around the world. And if our numbers are right, Bob, was the 1961 New Zealand PGA Championship your first professional victory?
My first victory as a professional was a 36-hole pro-am event leading up to the New Zealand Open. And in that field was Peter Thompson and Kel Nagel. And I think I shot 66, 67 and won comfortably. I think it was before the New Zealand Open. My first Open, New Zealand Open as a professional, which of course Peter Thompson won, and Kel Nagel beat me in the final of the PGA match play. Yes, I had won prior to that 1961 New Zealand PGA.
Gotcha. And that's probably one that you competed in a few times. Tell us a little bit about your early years before you decided, I think it was in 63, to play more full-time in the States.
When I turned pro in 1960, I wasn't immediately accepted as a member of the New Zealand PGA. And I know Bruce could probably reflect on it better than what I do. Peter Thompson also had the same problems of being accepted by the PGA. And certain countries, you had to be a member of a PGA before you could accept prize money.
Right.
So Great Britain was one place where you didn't need that requirement, and that's why I went there. Well, actually, I kicked off my professional career in South Africa. I was accepted there. Didn't win anything in South Africa, but had a couple of second places in the South African tour before I went on to Europe. I had 2 years playing the European tour. Won the a 36-hole pro-am in my first year. In the second year, I won, I don't know, about Swiss Open, and tied in a Dax, about three tournaments, I think I won. So by the end of 1962, I was starting to think about playing the USA. And, of course, I just met and signed up with the Mark McCormack and IMG to be. He was just working out of a law firm in 1962 when I first met him in Johannesburg. He was in South Africa with Arnold doing an exhibition tour with Gary Player. And the one tournament which Arnold played in 62 was the Transvaal Open in Johannesburg, which I believe Gary won, and I managed to finish second. And so that I came to the attention of Mark McCormack, and through a mutual friend, George Bloomberg. We didn't sign a contract, but we made a verbal agreement that he would take care of my affairs and future in golf.
So, Bob, you didn't waste much time. You came over to the U.S., really, I think, to start playing more full-time here, and boom, you win the Houston Classic at Memorial Park Golf Course by one over Fred Hawkins.
Well, and Jack Nicklaus was in there somewhere. yeah, they had a pretty good field, actually. I think Palmer and Nicklaus, and I don't know about Player, I think... And that was a pretty decent check, too. I think something like $9,000 for first in 1963 was pretty good money. So, no, that would that was in about May, I believe. Just less than 2 months before I went to Lytham for the Open Championship.
Yeah, so first PGA Tour event ever won by a left-handed golfer. Bruce, of course... you won that about 9 years later, but Bob, you must have gone into Lytham then for that Open Championship with a little bit of confidence coming off that victory in Houston.
Oh, indeed, yes. I'd enjoyed a little bit of success. My first tournament in that particular year was in Phoenix, and I missed the cut there. Made last money in Tucson the following week. I think it amounted to $30. So my first check in the USA was $30. Tie for about 25th place. There was only about 25 money spots back in those days, you must remember also.
That's right.
Following week, I did have success in New Orleans and I think Pensacola, and made pretty good checks, well, over $1,000 in both of them. That was leading up to Houston. So, no, it gave me a lot of confidence and going into the Open at Lytham. And I was, you know, a winner. I knew I could beat the best of them on a given day or over 4 days, of course. So, I must have played inspired golf at Lytham, resulting from my win in Houston.
And I think I remember you saying that there was a handful of the usual suspects that you were really focused on that week, and that would include, of course, the big three, and then a couple of Aussies, as I remember, Peter Thomson and Kel Nagel.
Yes, Arnold, Jack, and Gary, and Peter Thomson and Kel Nagel. They, I felt, were the ones to beat, and of course that was the event which, the major, which Jack Nicklaus felt that he had in control and could have won, but he managed to make bogeys on the last two holes, finished 5-5, whereas Phil Rogers and I finished 4-4 and beat Jack by one shot, I think it was, and of course we had the inevitable 36-hole playoff the final day.
It was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday with the Saturday playoff.
Yeah, well, of course, the reason for that was that all the pros had to get back to their members over the weekend, so that's why the event had to finish on the Friday.
So for our listeners who are probably too young to remember this, this is back when the Open Championship not only had a 36-hole final, so that would have been the Friday, then you've got to go another 36 to settle things the final day, and that kind of gets down to an endurance contest, doesn't it?
Well, 72 holes over 2 days is certainly an endurance contest, and I happened to mention it at the prize giving, that was the end of 36-hole playoffs. I think right from that moment, well, from that year, it was an 18-hole playoff.
Just going back a little bit into the tournament proper itself, after, I guess, the morning round on the Friday, which would have been after 54 holes, you led by one. Of course, that 66 in the morning on Friday must have helped things.
Well, it did. I think Phil Rogers was leading after two rounds. I don't have that info in front of me, but I played the final 36 holes with Phil Rogers, and I know Jack Nicklaus was playing in front of us. The reason I remember standing on the 16th tee, which is right beside the 17th green at Lytham, and we watched... As we were standing on the tee, we watched Jack overshoot the green with his second shot. And, of course, he played a poor – well, he had a difficult lie, played a poor chip and made a five there. And, of course, he drove it in the bunker on the 18th hole, made a five out of that. So, I think Jack was playing two or three groups in front of Phil Rogers and I. And I believe we were right at the end of the field.
Just take us to that last hole. You had a fairly long two-putt from, I think, front left of the green. Phil had about a 12-footer for birdie, which would have won it for him. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about the details of that last hole in regulation?
Well, I hit a 6-iron into the green, and it was about 40 feet. Might have been, I'm not sure whether it was just on or just off the edge of the green, 40 feet away. Phil Rogers hit a very good shot. I think he had a shorter shot, second shot, maybe a wedge 9-iron, and I hit it 12 feet from the hole. I putted up about 4 or 5 feet past, and Phil had the 12-footer, obviously, to win, which I don't think he got it, the 12-footer, anywhere near the hole. It was about 2.5 feet short and wide of the hole, and he proceeded to putt out, which he did, he's quite entitled to, and the ball did almost a 360 around the cup. It fell in off the edge. He basically hit two very poor putts from 12 feet. The second putt did drop, which left me with a 5-footer to tie him, and which in those days, five footers were virtually gimmies. So I dispensed with a five footer comfortably.
I don't know about and that.
that took us into another day.
So, yeah. What again, people may forget, particularly younger folks who might not have ever seen the footage of this, but Phil Rogers did curl in that 2.5-footer after about 3/4 revolution around the cup. And then what did he do? He proceeded to take his tam and drop it onto the hole, didn't he?
He did, which Henry Longhurst, I think, nearly fell out of the tower, whatever tower he was in, commentating on it. It was a lot of media took offense. It didn't faze me because I'm quite used to Phil and his antics. And what I recall most about Phil is if you went to a casino in Las Vegas and he happened to be there, you knew he was there because he was very loud and in the crap games. Throwing his cap over the holders to make sure the ball didn't come out was not something which unexpected as far as I was concerned.
Well, it was certainly bad form in the day, but obviously it didn't faze you because you popped that putt in, and that was a lot of pressure, but off you go to a 36-hole playoff. And when in the round, or the second round, I guess, did you feel like, okay, I think I can get it home from here?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
We were pretty close after the first 18 in the morning, and I maintained a lead certainly all the way on the second 18, although I think it was the second 18, I hit it out of bounds on the third hole. Not exactly sure, but making a double bogey there narrowed the margin. But right from after that, that going out of bounds, I just improved on my lead until eventually won by, I think it was eight shots.
Yeah, so you shoot 140. And Phil shoots 148, so obviously a comfortable lead coming in. You one putted 12 of the first 20 holes. Now that's more in character with the Sir Bob Charles I'm familiar with.
Well, of course you must remember that we were using the small ball in those days, and it's much easier to hit a small ball into a big hole than it is to hit a big ball into a small hole. And, That's basically been my philosophy.
There you go.
If you imagine you're putting into a big hole, it's it relieves a lot of the strain, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Bob. Good point.
Well, Bruce, I didn't know that not only was the ball bigger in America, but the holes are bigger in Britain. In Britain, is that right?
That's right.
The hole was always the same size, but it was never smaller or bigger.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, it was a great, great win. First Kiwi and lefty to win a major. As you said, it was the last 36-hole playoff for good reason.
Absolutely.
I remember Seve Ballesteros' uncle, who I've met in Pedreña, Spain, Ramon Soto, was T7 in that event. And Bruce Devlin, I think you played in that event as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah. But I wasn't anywhere near the playoff, I can assure you. Mr. Charles and Nicholas and Phil they had it pretty much by themselves the last day.
How did that change your life, Bob?
Well, I felt my future was assured in the professional game. it certainly made life a lot easier for me with as far as contracts, exhibitions, and of course it made Mark McCormack's job a lot easier to get invitations to this, that, and the other. It opened a lot of doors for me, and I was very fortunate, and that was early in my career too.
Well, the other thing that you guys can tell our listeners about, I think five times in the 60s, the PGA Championship was conducted the week after the British Open. Now, this is in a time when it was much more difficult to travel. And how did you guys manage to do that for those times when you tried to play those back-to-back, or did you not do that?
Well, as far as I was concerned, everybody left Lytham on the Saturday morning perhaps, and flew back. Those that were playing in the PGA in Dallas had gone back, so I had to wait an extra day, got in a little later, which the one thing I remember about that, the PGA, which Jack won, of course, was the heat. I think it got up to something like close to 120 degrees daytime, and nighttime it was it never got below 90 degrees. And to go from Great Britain to Texas with a, let's see, it would have been only about 60 degrees and at maximum, and in the UK to 120 degrees was quite a turnaround. So it was a big adjustment as far as the weather temperature went.
Plus, you had six rounds in Great Britain, and then you might have even participated in a little celebration, correct? And then traveled back, and then.
No, well, the celebration after I won was just my wife Verity, a friend from. Actually, the manager of the New Zealand team at St Andrews for the Eisenhower, and Jim Schooler. And, of course, poor old Phil Rogers was by himself. I think everybody had left town. So it was just about four of us, I think. I don't recall any others. So we did have in those days, I only drank beer. I'm a little more sophisticated these days. I have the odd glass of wine.
I'm just checking on you, that's all. I thought adding that celebration probably made it a little harder in Dallas.
Yes, not really, because I think I had one pretty good round there from what I recall in the 67 or thereabouts, but I think I might have been, well, certainly in the top 20 anyway, but it was quite a change and experiencing those kind of conditions.
Yeah, well, you did. You finished tied 13th after winning the week before at Lytham. And again, just for our listeners to fully appreciate what you guys went through, I mean, travel was hard enough, particularly where you guys were coming from and traveling the globe as global players. But to have majors back-to-back, I guess the folks nowadays, they can't even fathom doing that, can they?
Well, of course, we did travel in jet planes in those days. They went a little faster than the old piston engine planes, which I started out with and flying around the world. You could get to anywhere, and just within 24 hours, you could be at the next tournament if it was that far away. But no, we were used to that and adjusted to it. And it was, no, we. Didn't think too much of it. These days, of course, they all have their NetJets, fractional ownership and aircraft, which I did. And in fact, NetJets extended my career in senior golf from the age of 60 to 70, which extended my playing career on for those 10 extra years. And jet travel is quite different to the days of Bruce. Were you at the World Cup and Saint-Nom-la-Bretèche in Paris, where we had to fly from Paris to Melbourne in Australia for an Australian Open.
Yes, sir, I was.
Now, that was before the days of, I think, was that jet travel, or was it, I'm not exactly sure whether it was piston engines, that was...
I think we'd gotten to the jets just barely by that time. I think we come back in 707s.
Right, that's right. That was 707 was the start of jet travel, wasn't it? Mm.
Yes, it was. Yeah, so that was a long trip. But, you know, going back to the back-to-back majors, you know, from players from around the world outside of the US, it was always something that we, what we would call international players, wanted to win was the Open. And for the Americans, it was a heavy expense to go over there. The prize money wasn't as good as what they could make back in the United States. So, you know, I think it was really about, I don't know, it's probably around about 1960 when Arnold started to go over and play in what used to be the British Open, that sort of created the great interest that it certainly has today, for sure.
Well, you're right, Bruce. I didn't play in 1960, and of course that was when another Australian, Kel Nagle, won the Open, beating Arnold, I think, by just one or two strokes.
Yeah.
But I was there the following year, 1961, when Arnold won again. So winning those two back-to-back Opens certainly brought the event to the forefront of international golf.
It sure did. You know, we've got a lot more individual triumphs that we want to talk about, Bob, but the thing I'm most anxious to talk about is in 1964, as Bruce alluded to, you guys paired up in the CBS Golf Classic against Tony Lehman, Bobby Nichols, and we talked to Bobby Nichols about this recently, and we'll share some of his recollections. But was it the McCormick connection with IMG that brought you guys together that year? Do you remember?
Maybe, but Bob and I had been, you know, obviously we first met in 1958, so we knew one another fairly well, and I think the friendship was more than the association with McCormick, wouldn't you say, Bob?
Well, yes, and being an international team also.
That's right.
That gave the event a little bit of extra something. Of course, I have a record of that. I think you probably do have too. Finally had big reels of film
digitized
onto CDs or DVDs. I don't know the difference.
Yeah.
But it's in black and white, of course. It was before the days of color, and it was a big event at the end of the season, held in Palm Springs, Palm Desert. And of course, I think in the semifinal we beat Sam Snead and Gardner Dickinson.
Correct.
You should see the expression on their faces, Sam Snead in particular, when I was holding these putts. And it was a memorable occasion, and we combined well, for us, a very successful event and good money. And in fact, I've got a cup which I haven't put it on display. In fact, I don't know quite where to display. It's quite a large cup, thanks to CBS and their involvement.
Yeah, well, it was really fun for us too, because you know, in those days, Bobby Nichols had just won the PGA Championship, and Tony Lima, Champagne Tony Lima, was the big name, really, you know, from a fan standpoint, aside from Arnold. And some of the comments that I'm sure you heard them too, Bob, if you replayed the tape, but they were shaking their head, particularly on your little stretch on the back nine, where, if you remember correctly, you made it from about 18 feet at 10, about 8 feet at 11, about 30 feet at 12, and about 4 feet at 13, and then finally at 14, when I hit my putt 45 feet from the hole, you said, come on, you know, your turn to make one, and damned if it didn't go in from 45 feet. So that was it for them. They were ready to pitch the towel in, I think, after that.
But what you must remember, though, is that I hold all these putts, but you were always inside me, and you were there as a backup. So I wasn't concerned as to whether I made or missed my putt. I knew that you were there inside of me as a backup. So, no, it was great fun. And, of course, I guess we were the underdogs, and
right.
I'm all for underdogs winning events.
There you go. It was a great partner. Great partner, Mike.
I had mentioned, Bob, I had mentioned to Bruce that I did watch the tapes. I found it on internet somewhere. And as you said, it was a lot of these tapes were lost in a fire in a CBS warehouse, but they recovered most of the holes, not all of them. And I specifically remember, because they must have had you guys all mic'd up. So
they
specifically remember. Every time one of you hold a putt, you could hear Nichols or Lima in the background, and they're just talking to themselves. They don't know what to think.
Yeah, no, the old what, you slipped it in your hip pocket, didn't you? We were wired for sound.
Right, wired for sound. So, Bob, after 64, Bob, you jumped right out early in 1965, won the Tucson Open Invitational. And I understand that you only committed like 5 minutes before the entry deadline was closed, and damned if you didn't win.
You're correct there, and I don't know why I left it so late to enter. Obviously, I was either not quite ready with my golf game, or I think one of the factors was it was a brand new golf course. The National, does that ring any bells? The National Golf
Correct.
Club?
Yeah, Tucson National.
So nobody knew too much about the golf course, and I you're right. I didn't leave it too late. I just got in time. And I had a good week there, obviously, with all parts of the game. And I recall a couple of shots I hit. One was an uphill par three, which I can't remember who I was playing with, but I hit this 2-iron, which most guys were using woods on, and in fact I was using the same clubs that I won the Open with, and they were performing well that particular week. I'm not sure how long after I won the Open that I continued using those clubs, but they were a pretty good set, and I've now got them proudly displayed in my home golf club here in Christchurch, the Christchurch Golf Club.
Good. That's great.
We'll jump ahead a little bit, at least on the U.S. tour in 67. You win the Atlanta Classic at Atlanta Country Club by 2 over Tommy Bolt, Gardner Dickinson, and Richard Crawford. What do you remember about that one?
Well, another good week. It was good money. A brand new golf course. I think it was the first time we played there.
That is
in Atlanta,
right.
The Atlanta Country Club, was it? Yes.
It was, yes.
I don't know where the other guys were playing and who finished ahead of what, but I did get in. All I remember is I got into strife on the 17th hole. I hit a poor tee shot, and not looking too good for my second, but I played a good recovery, and I don't know whether I made a bogey 5, but I was a bit lucky there. And of course, the 18th was a par 5, which I don't don't think I could reach, but some of the players were reaching. And anyway, I sneaked home and that one. And no, it was a lot of satisfaction there.
You know, you look back in golf at all the great golf events that have happened in the Atlanta area, but that was really the first, I think, modern era PGA Tour event was that 1967 Atlanta Classic.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's go north of the border to what I remember as a child. I remember this as being a very prestigious event with major-like status, and that was the Canadian Open, which you won in 1968. That was at St. George's Golf and Country Club by 2 over JWN.
Yes. Well, George Knudsen was figuring there in the early rounds of the event. And Bruce, you would have been there as well, I think.
I was there. Certainly was, Bob.
You were there. So lo and behold, in the final round, I'm paired with Billy Casper and Jack Nicklaus. I don't know whether I was leading or what our status was, but I certainly made a lot of long putts on that occasion, and came to the last hole with a was it a one-shot lead. I think I might have been one ahead of Jack, both at reasonable drives. I had a 7-iron to the green, which I hit with less than 2 feet from the hole. So that was it. And in fact, Jack, who had a wedge, I think he missed the green and had to get it up and down from off the green to finish second.
Yeah, Bruce, the cachet around that event was much greater back then.
Certainly was. For us, it sort of was considered a fifth major. As a matter of fact, if somebody won two of the other four majors, the Canadian Open champion went to the playoff series where they had I think they took all the major champions and they four guys played every year. So if somebody won twice two majors, then the Canadian Open champion went and joined the foursome.
So, Bob, by this time, you're finishing up your sixth year, let's call it, playing a lot in the States. Who were some of the guys you were closest to back then?
Well, I suppose more the foreign players, so to speak, the Australians, the South Africans, and, of course, I was the only New Zealander. But and, of course, Tony Jacklin was the British. I had a few close American friends, Rod Funseth being one, and a lot of our friendships developed through our families. Our wives get together with our children, and everybody was driving by car. Nobody thought of flying in those days. Car was the mode of travel from tournament to tournament. So we all stayed at the same hotels. Howard Johnson's and places which, well, you don't hear much about Howard Johnson's anymore, do you?
No, maybe their ice cream.
Yeah. That's right. So, it was through our families that we developed our friendships and,
We've heard a lot of stories from our guests, Bruce, particularly back in those days, 60s and 70s, about life on the road, on the tour. And, of course, you found yourself on occasion on a Greyhound bus, but a lot of trips with the families, a lot of time at the pool with the wife and the kids, trading off babysitting each other's families, huh?
Yeah, pretty often, like Bob said, we got closer to one another because of our families. And usually there'd be one of the wives that would do the shopping and take care of some of the kids while the other wives got to go watch their husband play golf. And then we'd sit around the motel of a night and fire up the barbie and have something to eat around the pool, which was pretty nice. And Bob, we even had a beer in those days, didn't we, around the pool?
Oh, yeah, that's all I drank was beer, yeah. But might I say that when we arrived, I don't know what year it was, at the Colonial in Fort Worth, the clubhouse had set aside a room for babysitting. So that enabled the wives to come out and walk with us pros. And I think that that was the start, the Colonial. Am I, well, you won the Colonial, didn't you, Bruce? I mean, you should know Colonial better than what I do. Good memories.
Good memory too, Bob. That was the first place where they had babysitters. They even had drivers that would take the girls to put their dry cleaning in to the dry cleaners. And I believe Colonial was the first place where they ever gave the players food to eat for nothing.
Yeah, you could be right. Could be right, yeah. Wow. Did they ever invite you back there? They've still got the Colonial. Have you been back there at all recently? Do you attend it?
I attend it sometimes, but I still work with Michael Toth trying to help promote the place. And, of course, the greatest thing that ever happened to Colonial was Charles Schwab to come in there a couple of years ago. And, boy, it put the life back in that tournament. They needed it bad. And he's been a great asset to this community here.
And where's your plaid jacket? Do you have it in a cupboard, or do you get to wear it at Colonial?
I do. Every time I go to Colonial, I have to wear it. It's in my closet, and I must say I'm very proud to wear it.
And it still fits perfectly.
Yes, it does, except it gets a little tighter around the belly. Well, how did you guess, Bob? Oh, dear.
And Bob, he's the proud owner of a replacement jacket because the original never made it to Australia.
Yeah, they sent me, you know, in the old days, it was a greeny colored plaid. Now it's a red colored plaid. Don't ask me the actual name of the plaid. But yeah, when I first moved back in this area and went to the Champions Center at Colonial, they asked me where my jacket was. And I said, well, it was sent to Australia, but I never got it. So they made me another one, which was very nice of them.
Oh, very good. Great. Mm.
So, Bob, if we can, let's move forward to the 1969 Piccadilly World Match Play Championship at Wentworth. And before we talk about your wins there and who you took care of before winning outright, what do you guys remember about this event? The one thing I remember David Graham talking about is you guys were able to be driven around in Rolls Royces.
No, it was only the winner that had the honor of a Rolls Royce. The others, we had Vandenplaus. What were they called?
Daimlers.
Daimler Vandenplaus.
Daimler.
That's right. But they were chauffeur driven, and it was... Well, of course, the first one that I played in was, I don't know what year it was, but everybody stayed at the Savoy Hotel in London. And it was more than an hour's drive from Wentworth. And it was a pretty long day. And particularly if you had a social event in the evening, an hour getting there, an hour getting back, and 36 holes of golf also was made it a long day. But I think it was the last time we did that. For future, I played in only two or three more than that. They rented houses which are close to Wentworth, with staffed houses with cooks and valets, and I didn't have to make my own bed. Somebody made it for me, which is, I'm getting a bit tired of it in my old age, I might add, making my own bed. But I wish I was back on the road at times where somebody else can make it for me. But we were spoiled rotten. And as a matter of fact, I think, it might have been the year I won, because I know I got sick, some form of food poisoning, overindulging, obviously, and the foie gras not to mention the tipple, but I think on the final day when I won, I wasn't dehydrated, but I didn't have a lot of food in the stomach, but I did have enough energy to get there in the finish. But no, we enjoyed the houses much better than staying in the Savoy Hotel.
Yeah, so a couple of your matches. I think one was against Maurice Bembridge. You beat him 6-5, and then you beat a guy that we visited with just briefly and recently, and that was Masters champion Tommy Aaron. You dispatched him 9-7 before meeting Gene Littler in the final.
To win by those margins against those quality players, you wonder, somebody must have been putting well. Unfortunately, it was yours truly. But I was making a bunch of birdies, and I think the record book shows that the front nine, I was shooting 31, 32 on the front nine and scoring in the mid to high 60s. So, it was two comfortable wins. Then I caught up with Gene Littler, the Gene the Machine, and I put the same act on him as I did with Morris and Tommy. We came to the last hole all square. Gene hit two magnificent wood shots onto the par 5 18th at Wentworth, and I hit a sloppy second shot, which went a little bit too close to the trees on the right. Anyway, I pitched on about 27 feet from the hole, and I'm not sure who putted first, but obviously Gene had a two-putt for birdie, and I managed to ease in my 27-footer to go into extra holes. So it was even a better putt than much longer putt than the one to tie the Open. So to tie Gene Littler was quite something, and the first extra hole, I think I hit a 4-iron for my second, very close to the again. The first hole it went with was in those days a par 5, and I hit a 4-iron second, I don't know, 3 or 4 feet from the hole, and for a 3. That was that, and of course I didn't know it, and I don't think Gene knew it, that there was a bereavement in the family. I don't think he was playing under that cloud, but he certainly knew. Who was it? Was it his wife's parents or somebody passed away? I'm not too sure of the details there. But Gene was one of the greats of golf, he had a simple golf swing, and Gene the Machine, as they called him, was. So that was a feather in my cap to take him out in the 36 holes of match play.
Yeah, especially with the eagle on the first playoff hole to beat him. Bruce, that name, Gene Littler's come up a few times, hasn't it?
Yes, it sure has. He was, like Bob said, he had a beautiful golf swing. He was actually one of the nicest men that I think has ever played the game of golf. And it was indeed my pleasure, along with, I'm sure Bob feels the same way, that just to meet Gene and be around him was a lot of fun to be with him.
Yeah, he was a quiet man, just like myself.
Yeah, he was.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.